listener support.
WISS 1100 AM Berlin, W252 DR Oshkosh,
and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Mike Dubusky. More than 30,000 union workers for Boeing are on strike, demanding pay raises and pension plans. The strike is concentrated in the Seattle and Portland areas. ABC's Alex Perez is in Washington State.
It's the first strike at Boeing in 16 years and comes after a turbulent few years for the company. Two fatal 737 MAX crashes, a door plug falling off a passenger jet mid-flight, and a problem-plagued Starliner spacecraft that left two astronauts stranded at the International Space Station. Boeing's CFO says they're ready to keep negotiating.
The two parties are set to sit down with federal negotiators this week. A police official tells ABC News that new bomb threats have targeted medical facilities in Springfield, Ohio. All facilities have been swept, some have reopened, and it comes after former President Trump repeated a debunked claim at a rally last night that Haitian immigrants were killing and eating pets in the area. This is ABC News. Boar's Head has announced it will shut down its Virginia plant linked to 9 deaths and nearly 60 hospitalizations. Follows a listeria outbreak traced back to its deli meats. Gas prices are down, according to AAA. $3.24 a gallon is the national average for a gallon of regular. That's more than 20 cents lower than a month ago and more than 60 cents down from a year ago. Some experts say the country could see the national average dip below $3 in the coming months, driven by record domestic oil production. And a child in Washington State is recovering after being attacked by a river otter.
Most otters will tend to steer clear of people, but they can be territorial.
State wildlife official Matt Blankenship, speaking with ABC affiliate KOMO, he says the otter grabbed the child and pulled them underwater. The incident report says the child resurfaced after a few moments and was rescued by their mother. Federal wildlife officials were called to trap and kill the otter, which will be tested for rabies. Mike Dubusky, ABC News.
Hey there, this is Carrie Joy with today's Work Money Minute, going out to anybody who wants to improve their money life, but maybe doesn't know where to start. Step one is just to look at your spending. That's it. Open up your credit card statement or your bank account and look at all the transactions and pay attention for just 5 minutes. Step two is to give yourself a minute to consider, does your spending reflect the life that you want to have? Is it getting you where you want to go? Which is why step three is really important. Be kind to yourself. Tell yourself that you can be good with money. The science is very clear about this, folks. Believing that you can is how you make change happen in your life. Today, I know I can be good with money. And that started with me telling myself I could be good with money. For more tips on how to save more and spend less, head on over to workmoney.org. In the meantime, this is Carrie Joy saying, take good care.
I'm Lisa Hale with WISS News. Your news in depth. Find it in the news section at WISS.FM.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. A new study finds lower-wage workers in Wisconsin are making more money, but Black, Latino, and women workers still lag behind. Mark Richardson reports.
Study by the High Road Strategy Center at the University of Wisconsin-Madison finds the state's job market hit record levels in the second quarter, and the inflation-adjusted medium hourly wage has increased by 97 cents. Report co-author Laura Dresser says the increase in the median wage is just making up for the period that inflation ran ahead of earnings in 2022.
In these last 5 years, lower-wage workers have seen their wages go up by 8% in terms of purchasing power, real value, and high-wage workers have only had wages go up about 1%.
The State of Working Wisconsin report says the number of jobs in Wisconsin has topped 3 million and unemployment remains steady at 3%. The study also found the rate of unionized workers in Wisconsin dropped by one-third between 2011 and 2023, the steepest decline in union membership across the Midwest region. Despite the increase in wages, the report says significant wage gaps remain between white men and workers who are Black, Latino, or female.
When you focus on improving the quality of jobs, especially at the bottom of the labor market, you also are looking to close racial and gender gaps because it is Black and brown and women workers who are dominant in lower wage jobs.
The report makes some recommendations. It suggests raising the minimum wage from $7.25 to $15 $15 an hour to help close the pay gap, rolling back the state's so-called right-to-work laws to restore union rights, and increasing investments in child care and education to provide relief for families and employers. For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Mark Richardson.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
Continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. Partly sunny today, highs in the low 80s. We'll have southeast winds at about 5 to 10 miles per hour. For tonight, mostly cloudy, a low of 65. Sunday, partly sunny, a high near 85. Partly cloudy, 64 Sunday night. Mostly sunny and 85 again Monday.
It's 76 at our studios.
Broadcasting from the Civic Media Studios on South Main Street, this is Oshkosh Air Support, 1100 AM and 98.3 FM, WISS.
I'm Scott Klug. I've been an Emmy Award-winning reporter, a four-term member of Congress, and a federal lobbyist. And like a huge swath of the American public, I'm lost in the middle. This 14-part podcast explains how we got into this mess, where the extremes now pass for the normal. And we're going to try to understand when politics turned into a blood sport and gleefully point the fingers at some of the people we think are to blame. And we'll offer up some green shoots of hope on how America can turn it all around.
Lost in the Middle, America's Political Orphans, is brought to you by the American Property Owners Alliance, safeguarding the dream of property ownership. Episode 5. Breaking ranks, the joys of ticket splitting.
Therefore, I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow. Vice President Ford will be sworn in as president at that hour in this office.
Oh boy, it was going to be a doozy in the Klug household. In the wake of the Watergate scandal, Richard Nixon was stepping down. The Maginot Line had been crossed. Look, I grew up in a mixed marriage. My mom, the Irish Catholic, Democratic daughter of a union railroad worker. My dad, a German Lutheran, Chamber of Commerce, American Legion Republican. To keep peace at the dinner table, politics and the Immaculate Conception were off limits. But the truth is, like many Wisconsinites of that vintage, ticket splitting was rampant. My mom voted for Republican governors, and my dad was a huge fan of the iconoclastic Democratic Senator Bill Proxmire, who served for three decades. But my mom never, ever forgave him for talking her into voting for Richard Nixon. Moments after I finished my dinner plate, I was out the door that night to escape the nuclear exchange that was coming. But when next election rolled around, they shopped like diners in a Chinese restaurant. One from column A, one from column B. This Republican, that Democrat.
So, you know, the height of ticket splitting was probably in the late 80s or early 90s. There were lots of voters, especially who voted for Republican presidents, Reagan and Bush, but voted for Democratic members of Congress. That's a very common pattern.
University of Wisconsin political scientist Barry Burden.
Something like a quarter of voters in those elections were splitting their tickets. So on the same ballot, voting for a presidential candidate and a congressional candidate of different office.
Today, ticket splitting has largely collapsed in the House. Listen to this number from 2020. Voters in only 23 out of 435 congressional districts voted for the president of one party and a congressional candidate of another. But in the 22 election, ticket splitting suddenly surged in a number of Senate and governor races around the country. And not surprisingly, it happened in a number of battleground states, the same maps you see in every recent presidential election. University of Virginia professor Kyle Condict is trying to figure out if the 2022 ticket splitting was a trend or maybe just an outlier.
Yeah, you could still find states where there's like a huge gap between like maybe a governor and a Senate election in a given year. Like if you look at Vermont, for instance, you know, Democrats won the Senate race there, replaced Patrick Leahy by like 40 points. And at the same time, Phil Scott, kind of a classic, kind of old school Yankee Republican moderate, he won by about 40 points himself. So there's like an 80 point gap between Senate and governor. So obviously a ton of people were voting, you know, Republican for governor and Democratic for Senate. You saw that in New Hampshire to a lesser degree with Chris Sununu winning pretty comfortably and Maggie Hassan winning by almost 10 points herself, smaller margin than Sununu, but still doing quite well.
Look, I personally think ticket splitting is very healthy for the country. Voters consciously thinking about their choices, not robotically pulling a lever. We're going to zero in on Wisconsin and Georgia, two very different places, two very different governor-senator races, and not much in common except their best football teams wear a big G on their helmets. I'm Scott Klug. I've been an Emmy award-winning reporter, a four-term member of Congress, and a federal lobbyist. And like a huge swath of the American public, I'm lost in the middle. This 14-part podcast explains how we got into this mess, where the extremes now pass for the normal. And we're going to try to understand when politics turned into a blood sport and gleefully point the fingers at some of the people we think are to blame. And we'll offer up some green shoots of hope on how America can turn it all around.
Just a reminder, my name is Madeline. I'm going to be your tour guide and duck driver on today's tour. And we are sitting on World War II amphibious duck, Ida. All right, we are now approaching our first water splashdown on today's tour.
Wow! Welcome to Wisconsin Dells. And that's a duck jammed with tourists. World War II landing craft that can both drive on streets and trails and also meander around the area's rivers carved out in the last ice age. Here's how Madison screenwriter and columnist John Roach describes the Wisconsin Dells.
It is the default vacation destination for scores of families in Chicago, Milwaukee, Racine, Kenosha, Minneapolis, when they don't have the money to go to Disney World. Crazy carny sites, water rides, people tour the Wisconsin River in amphibious ducks, which were left over from World War II, and eating cotton candy and go from one tourist thing to the next. And they come away with some beaded moccasins.
But the best place in the world to be if you're 11 years old.
Absolutely.
Full disclosure, in third grade, I got my moccasins and a beaded belt to boot. The Dells has been a tourist haunt since the late 1940s. But all joking aside, today it's a massive economic engine with 5 million visitors a year. Wisconsin Dells sits in Columbia County. It's an area north and west of Madison, featuring a ton of dairy farmers, I'm sure you're surprised, small towns, and collar Madison suburbs, and ticket splitters. Wisconsin's incumbent Democratic Governor Tony Evers and Senator Ron Johnson both faced tight races in 2022. Very different people, very different politically, and very different personally. If they made a movie about incumbent Tony Evers, they could cast the late Fred Rogers in the part. A former elementary school teacher with big glasses and a frame so slight a strong wind could blow him to Iowa. In 2022, every incumbent governor, except in Nevada, was reelected. 28,000 people in Columbia County voted. Evers won by a margin of 1,000. And on election night, poked fun at himself when he won the state by 90,000 votes.
Some people call it boring, but you know what, Wisconsin, as it turns out, boring wins, and Mr. Rogers is cool.
Incumbent Senator Ron Johnson had the tougher race against Evers' lieutenant governor and one-time Milwaukee activist Mandela Barnes. Often combative, Johnson was defensive about January 6th and firm in his convictions doubting the efficacy of masks and vaccines. But in the end, Barnes wilted under a barrage of attacks. Ticket splitters experts argue don't vote for who they like. They vote against who they don't like or they don't trust.
He's talking about defunding the police. Now, murder is up in Milwaukee 40%, the fourth highest increase in the country. Mandela Barnes, a dangerous Democrat.
Crime didn't work as an issue in many parts of the country, but it sure did in Wisconsin. In Columbia County, it was a squeaker. Johnson won the county by only 450 votes, the state by 27,000. But the big question is, what's in the water in Wisconsin? Aside from ducks driving down the river, ticket splitting seems baked into the Wisconsin DNA. While my family might have been subdued about political differences, boy, not in John Roach's family. Parents on opposite sides of the political spectrum, and with five brothers and sisters, the family meals could literally and metaphorically turn into a food fight.
My mom was absolutely left of center. She's south side of Chicago. Her mom took book in City Hall before she passed. Her dad was a streetcar conductor on the south side of Chicago. It's the old Irish political machine, which was obviously Democratic. My father was a small businessman and was an ardent Republican, made so especially because he had a sporting goods store on State Street in Madison, Wisconsin. And every time there was a Vietnam War protest, all his windows were broken.
And ticket splitting's a family tradition.
So it's a puzzle to me, too. Here's the thing. I'm not sure it's rational. As I was alluding to, there might be just this little chip on Wisconsin's shoulders where they don't want to give everything to one party. I think there might be something about Wisconsin where there's this common sense thread where they don't want anyone to have too much power. I don't think it's articulated, but if you look at some of the patterns, it's like, okay, well, we have this Republican senator, so we need a Democratic one. And we have this, you know, we've had this Republican governor for four terms, so let's get a couple Democratic senators in there. They try to balance it out in a kind of freestyle way.
Even the political science crowd can't explain it.
It tends to matter most in states like Wisconsin or Georgia, North Carolina, Arizona, where you have these very competitive statewide races. And even a small number of people, 5% of voters or 8% of voters going back and forth between the parties could change the outcomes even on the same ballot.
That's University of Wisconsin professor Barry Burden one more time.
There's kind of a magic here that no matter what happens with changing demographics, areas of the state growing, other areas of the state shrinking, influx of people from other places, the partisan balance tends to stay about 50-50.
There are some pronounced trends. Always Democratic Madison and surrounding Dane County, my former once battleground district, is whatever darkest blue color is in your box of crayons. It's also the fastest growing part of the state. And the dependable Republican Milwaukee suburbs are now purple. The northern third of the state is among the most pro-Trump areas in the country. And in western Wisconsin, the spillover Twin City suburbs just helped flip a congressional seat from blue to red.
It's not as though the state is not moving. It's dynamic. There are a lot of political things happening in different directions, but they seem to just offset almost in a perfect fashion.
This podcast is brought to you by the American Property Owners Alliance. Our country recognizes homeownership as one of the best ways to build wealth and stable communities. But over the years, support for homeownership has dwindled, and our leaders have lost sight of its value. We're working to change that. The American Property Owners Alliance is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that holds our leaders accountable to safeguard homeowners and communities. Visit PropertyOwnersAlliance.org to learn more and find out how you can join our efforts.
Georgia, Georgia.
3 decades ago, Georgia was solidly blue. But in 2003, it elected a Republican governor, the first in the state since Reconstruction, who then flipped the state legislature, and the congressional districts followed right along. 20 years later, with the explosive growth of the Atlanta suburbs, Georgia is now a purple ticket-splitting state. I called an old friend who now lives in Georgia to get his perspective. When I represented Madison in Congress, Errol Davis was the CEO of Alliant Energy and one of the few black CEOs in Wisconsin. Then he found a new passion and switched careers, becoming the chancellor of the University of Georgia system, appointed by a Republican governor, and later superintendent of Atlanta's public schools. He shops around for candidates he likes.
I've watched it transition from a rock rib, really conservative Republican area to a less conservative and now clearly blue and sometimes purple. If you look at the migration of people here, the state of Georgia has 9 million people. Over 6 million of them are in this area. I agree for the center, and I hope, you know, the quiet center becomes less quiet. But I reject excesses on both parts. I mean, I've always, no one has ever accused me of being progressive. Let me say that. I have, on the issues of civil rights, I'm clearly on the left, and on the issues of fiscal prudence, I'm clearly on the right.
There are a bunch of voters like him in the wealthy northern Atlanta suburbs of Roswell, Alpharetta, and Sandy Springs. If the Wisconsin Dells parking lots are overflowing with minivans, American-manufactured SUVs with Green Bay Packers stickers, here you'll find Georgia Bulldog decals and luxury brands like Lexus, BMW, and Mercedes, whose U.S. headquarters is just nearby. Average income in Columbia County, Wisconsin, $73,000. Here it's $145,000. Housing prices, $204,000 versus $624,000. In 2022, these Georgia cities voted for incumbent Republican Governor Brian Kemp and incumbent Democratic Senator Raphael Warnock. Georgia Democrats had high hopes for Stacey Abrams in her race against the incumbent Kemp. She nearly beat him in 2018 and had become a prominent national figure and a prolific fundraiser for her own campaign and the national party. But like I said, it was a good night for incumbents. Saba Long, an Atlanta communications director and a podcaster in her 30s who leans Democratic, gave Kemp his due.
Kemp is a likable guy. When you sit down and talk to him, he's approachable. He feels like, you know, like maybe the guy you work with or your cousin. There's an approachability and kind of salt of the earth vibe to him. Also, his messaging was spectacular. Over the course of his time as governor, he has been very consistent on Georgia being the number one place to do business, despite maybe some consternations of some Republicans about he's willing to work with Democrats on things that make sense, not particularly around the economy.
And aside from high marks on the economy, Kemp's stare down with Trump over his rants of election fraud gave him credence with independents and suburban women. She consistently lagged in the polls. Kemp got less than 50% in 18. In the rematch in 2022, he got 53%. But if you're a political junkie of any stripe, it was the Senate race that was fascinating. Senator Raphael Warnock, an Atlanta preacher, was elected in a runoff in 2020. Republicans blamed his win on Trump's election fraud claims, which had the dubious distinction of depressing Republican turnout and motivating anti-Trump suburban women. The GOP was amped up for a rematch. But then Trump, eager to prove them wrong and also hell-bent on revenge, pushed beloved University of Georgia football star Herschel Walker through the primary.
It is now a great pleasure to announce the winner of the 1982 Heisman Memorial Trophy from the University of Georgia, Herschel Walker.
But two major issues quickly framed the race. Character and an explicit appeal by Warnock's campaign to swing voters and independents, something rarely seen these days. Well, let's tackle character first. Here's one of my favorite campaign pratfalls of all time, the 2016 presidential race and Rick Perry's duh moment.
And I will tell you, it's three agencies of government when I get there that are gone. Commerce, education, and the, what's the third one there? Let's see.
You need five.
Oh, five, yeah, okay. So five. Commerce, education, and
EPA?
EPA, there you go. No, okay.
Let's stop deficit.
Seriously?
Now, maybe I can understand that a little bit. There are 438 federal agencies. Let's cut them some slack. But check this out. When Herschel Walker announced for the Senate, he spoke finally of his son. Son, as in singular. But, oops, suddenly there was another son.
New at 11, Republican Georgia Senate candidate Herschel Walker is acknowledging a second son. Previously, Walker hadn't publicly mentioned a 10-year-old son. His campaign confirmed the child after the Daily Beast reported Tuesday that the boy's mother had taken Walker to court to establish paternity for child support back in 2014. Walker's campaign says he has supported the child and that the suggestion that he hit his son is, quote, offensive and absurd.
And as they say in late night TV commercials, wait, there's more.
One day after admitting to having fathered a second son, Georgia U.S. Senate candidate Herschel Walker now says that he's the father of another son as well as a daughter. Until earlier this week, Walker had only publicly mentioned his 22-year-old son, Christian Walker. Well, this morning news broke of a third son out of wedlock who is now 13 years old and now an adult daughter who was born when he was the running back star for the University of Georgia.
Okay, forgetting the name of one cabinet agency is a little awkward, but three other kids? Melita Easters, a Georgia Democratic strategist, could not believe it.
I like to say that when the former president designated Walker his favorite U.S. Senate candidate for Georgia, nobody had vetted Walker. When you vet candidates, you like to have them walk onto the campaign trail with a carry-on roller bag. Walker was dragging steamer trunks. And those trunks full of baggage scuttled his campaign, especially with suburban women voters.
Listen to this Georgia focus group. Here's the background. 11 people who voted for Trump in 16 and switched to Biden in 20. Seven of them are Republicans, two are Democrats, and two are independents. And for the record, eight of the 11 voted for Governor Kemp. Rich Thau runs what he calls the Swing Vote Project in partnership with Axios. Rich is masterful in drawing out what people think. And here the single issue is very clear. It's character.
I don't think I felt comfortable trusting Walker at all. I mean, as far as his, past goes with women, and I know you can't believe everything, but I just didn't get a good feeling about it.
Walker, the guy has documented split personalities.
And I came to the conclusion that, okay, this guy is just not a political leader. I'm not going to put somebody in office who I don't feel has no knowledge of, like, politics.
Clearly, the Warnock campaign was hearing these same themes in its own research. Listen to the language in his commercials directly appealing to ticket splitters.
I'm a lifelong Republican.
I'm an independent.
I usually vote Republican.
But there is no way that I can vote for Herschel Walker.
The lies, the bizarre statements, I just don't get it. I vote for the person, not the party. So I'm voting for Raphael Warnock.
He has the best interest of Georgia in mind.
Remember early on in the episode, Professor Burden talked about ticket splitting peaking in the 90s. Since I represented a swing district in that era, I routinely ran ads talking about working with Democrats on issues like family and medical leave, which many Republicans opposed. But in an age of vicious campaign ads, Warnock doubled down and pivoted and used the long-abandoned playbook. CNN political commentators were gobsmacked.
Things work surprisingly well together.
Pizza with pineapple.
French fry and frosty.
Raphael Warnock and Ted Cruz?
That's right. Raphael Warnock partnered with Republican Ted Cruz to extend I-14, connecting military communities in Texas and Georgia.
Now, I can't say with certainty that Ted Cruz has never appeared in a Democratic Senate ad before, but I can't remember it.
I don't know what the benefit of naming Ted Cruz is if you're a Democrat in Georgia.
No, I know, but what it says to me, it sounds like they're going after independent voters.
Smart politics is Atlanta Democratic strategist Melita Easters, and actually a pretty good message for the body politic as a whole.
When we are at gridlock, as we are as a country, then you want to think that there are people who can work across the aisle. And so by dropping the name of a Republican many Democrats do not like, and even some Republicans do not like, he showed he could work across the aisle. And if we are ever to cure the gridlock, which has Washington at a standstill on many important issues, we have to have people who can work across the aisle.
Look, you can tell by the tone of this podcast, I'm a fan of ticket splitting. But Professor Kondek makes the case it might be a nice romantic idea, but if you believe in a party's political philosophy, strong government programs if you're a Democrat, less taxes and regulations if you're a Republican, a split ticket means you never accomplish anything.
I mean, yeah, I mean, I think there's like a certain kind of paint-by-numbers quality to politics now, which I think from a candidate's perspective is probably kind of disheartening. If someone says, I vote Democratic in every election because I believe in X, Y, and Z, or I vote Republican in every election because I believe in A, B, and C, I'm not going to sit here and tell that person that they're wrong for never voting for the other party. Because there's not necessarily a logical not the ticket split. It's just that I do feel like if fewer people's votes are sort of up for grabs, it probably makes politicians, particularly if you're the dominant party in a given state, probably are maybe less responsive. Maybe that leads to more corruption and that sort of thing because people feel like they can never lose. Like I look at Ohio recently, you know, as Democrats have sort of faded as an alternative, you have seen a number of pretty legitimate big scandals and I would say kind of cocky behavior.
But I think what happened in the fall of 22 is a much better model, and I'm not the only one. Here's Saba Long one more time.
I think ticket splitters are great. I talk a lot on my podcast about the need for competitive districts, the need to reconsider, you know, who's able to qualify as a candidate. You know, you see more and more often that candidates are wealthy and they're able to put in millions and millions of their own dollars. So for me, a ticket splitter means that you're going to have a more diverse political perspective. And it's not one party drowning out the views and concerns and thoughts of another. I'm all for it.
Jennifer is a mid-50s white woman, again from Rich's focus group in Atlanta.
I was a straight ticket Republican, and I felt that the issues and character were at play. And I think that Kemp does well on the economy. I think that Warnock has shown progress with issues. And so I knew going in that I was going to do a split ticket and that it was different than before. It felt liberating.
How so?
Well, you know, in the past, I felt like I had to be consistent with the party line. And I think we're allowed more these days to color outside the lines. It feels more comfortable to do that, to get it right.
Absolutely. Think, pause, get it right. Here's the team behind Lost in the Middle. Executive producer Jeff Mayers. Producer Todd Elba. Creative team Claudia Luz and Tony Wood. Edited by Aaron Zummers. Music by Brett William. Production at Civic Media. And a quick thanks to our partners at the American Property Owners Alliance.
Your home for Mino and the Mayor in the Morning. Weekdays from 6 till 8. Oshkosh Air Support, 1100 AM and 98.3 FM WISS.
ABC News, I'm Mike Dubusky. More than 30,000 union workers for Boeing are on strike, demanding pay raises and pension plans. The strike is concentrated in the Seattle and Portland areas. ABC's Alex Perez is in Washington State.
It's the first strike at Boeing in 16 years and comes after a turbulent few years for the company. Two fatal 737 MAX crashes, a door plug falling off a passenger jet mid-flight, and a problem-plagued Starliner spacecraft that left two astronauts stranded at the International Space Station. Boeing's CFO says they're ready to keep negotiating.
The two parties are set to sit down with federal negotiators this week. A police official tells ABC News that new bomb threats have targeted medical facilities in Springfield, Ohio. All facilities have been swept, some have reopened, and it comes after former President Trump repeated a debunked claim at a rally last night that Haitian immigrants were killing and eating pets in the area. This is ABC News.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
Bucky gets Bama. Hi, I'm Jimmy Cusco with sports, filling in for Mike Clemens. The Wisconsin Badgers play Alabama today in college football. Head coach Luke Fickell said that they feel prepared for everything they will see today.
I feel good. I mean, to be honest, we did a lot of that in the spring. We did a lot of that in fall camp in particular, saying, okay, we want offensively to take shots. We're going to script some of these things and make sure our guys are being challenged in ways. But, you know, it's harder when all of a sudden Saturdays come.
Kickoff is at 11 a.m. in Madison. The Brewers got a two-run home run from Rhys Hoskins and beat Arizona 2-1 on Friday night. The win, coupled with losses by all of the teams below them in the standings, moved Milwaukee's magic number down to 5. Same two teams, Brewers and Diamondbacks, tonight. Green Bay quarterback Jordan Love is listed as questionable for tomorrow's game with an MCL sprain. Malik Willis is expected to be the starter when the Packers take on the Colts on Sunday. Both teams are looking for their first win. Kickoff is at noon. Filling in for Mike Clemens, I'm Jimmy Cusco with Civic Media Sports.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. Partly sunny today, highs in the low 80s. We'll have southeast winds at about 5 to 10 miles per hour. For tonight, mostly cloudy, a low of 65. Sunday, partly sunny, a high near 85. Partly cloudy, 64 Sunday night. Mostly sunny and 85 again Monday. Currently, 78 degrees.
Sometimes life's challenges leave you feeling alone. We all need someone who understands and listens without judgment. That's what the 988 Wisconsin Lifeline is for. 988 is free and confidential. Trained counselors are ready to listen and provide support 24/7 for mental health and substance use concerns. You can contact 988 for yourself or for someone you know. Don't wait. Call or text 988 or chat online at 988wisconsin.org. 988 24/7. Call, text, chat. Here to support you.
Brought to you by the Wisconsin Department of Health Services.
From the home of the largest fly-in in the world, we are Oshkosh Air Support, 1100 AM and 98.3 FM, WISS.
I'm Scott Klug. I've been an Emmy Award-winning reporter, a four-term member of Congress, and a federal lobbyist. And like a huge swath of the American public, I'm lost in the middle. This 14-part podcast explains how we got into this mess, where the extremes now pass for the normal. And we're going to try to understand when politics turned into a blood sport and gleefully point the fingers at some of the people we think are to blame. And we'll offer up some green shoots of hope on how America can turn it all around.
Lost in the Middle, America's Political Orphans, is brought to you by the American Property Owners Alliance, safeguarding the dream of property ownership. The ghost of Bob La Follette. Today, everyone has an election reform idea. A noble cause, or just trying to change who wins? In episode 12 of Lost in the Middle.
Mark Twain, I think, said it best.
History doesn't repeat itself, but it often rhymes.
Mere passive citizenship is not enough. Men must be aggressive for what is right if government is to be saved from those who are aggressive for what is wrong.
That scratchy 100-year-old recording is Wisconsin favorite son Bob La Follette, often regarded as one of the five best senators in U.S. history.
The call comes to every citizen. It is an unending struggle to make and keep government representative. Each one should count it a patriotic duty to build at least a part of his life into the life of his country, to do his share in the making of America according to the plan of the fathers.
La Follette and his sometimes ally, but more frequently sparring partner Teddy Roosevelt, ushered a reform era into U.S. politics in the early days of the 20th century. Both were worried about the concentration of wealth, about growing inequality, and about the massive amount of money in politics.
They were concerned that the game was fixed.
That's one time Wisconsin State historian Michael Stevens talking about the progressive era.
And you had a group of individuals who were looking for a way to change the status quo. And around 1900, the idea of progressivism coalesced. You had reformers nationwide looking at how did we get into this problem and what can we do about that.
La Follette was at the forefront of the movement. It's hard to believe that this one reform was even necessary.
In order to challenge the influence of political bosses, like, for example, in Tammany Hall, progressives wanted to put more of the voting power back into the hands of the people. And one way they sought to do this was through the secret ballot. In other words, that the voting could be done in secret. And you may wonder, isn't that how voting is done? Well, not prior to this. Like, one of the reasons these political bosses were able to keep power is that they doled out their favors to members of the community, and they did so in exchange for their votes. And when these folks came to vote, it was done in the plain sight of the bosses. So, of course, they had to make good on their promise.
This is from a lecture on progressive politics at a website called Heimler's History. But that was just the start.
The other thing that La Follette was successful in doing is he believed in referendum, recall, and initiative.
Perhaps his most famous reform as governor of Wisconsin was one that eventually swept the country, the direct election of senators, which had historically been done by the state legislature and by party bosses. He believed the only way to change that was through a referendum. Stevens, one more time.
Well, La Follette, when he campaigned, he distributed literature. On one side of it supported Bob La Follette. On the other side was a reminder to vote yes on the referendum. So he would use his campaign machinery to campaign for both the cause and the man.
And now comes the history rhyme that Twain described.
So it certainly parallels the progressive reform era of about 100 years ago.
Catherine Gale sold her Wisconsin manufacturing company about 8 years ago, and since then has poured her considerable energy into the National Association of Nonpartisan Reformers.
People are frustrated with the political system writ large and across the spectrum of ideology. And so then there's a subset of those people who are proposing certain, you know, multiple different solutions. And I do believe that this kind of dissatisfaction will lead to voters grasping for change. They will grasp for change either in who they elect or how the systems themselves work or both.
That same evangelical zeal to reform today's politics echoes those familiar themes. It was then the concentration of wealth with Carnegie and Rockefeller. Today, Bezos and Koch. Too much money in politics led by railroad barons. Today, the era of super PACs. And rising inequality again shrinks opportunities for many. Last episode, we touched on redistricting reform and multi-party democracy. In this episode, ranked voting and open primaries. In part two of our stories on reform proposals, we begin in a very cold place with a very hot reform idea.
Do you want to see glaciers, bears, paying for gold? You name it, Alaska is the place.
And it's also home to a creative way to get out of gridlock, which delivered a major upset in a congressional special election in 2022.
More breaking news tonight, this time out of Alaska. We've got some projected results in a special election for a U.S. House seat. The state's former governor, Sarah Palin, was in the runoff. But NBC News can project that Democrat Mary Peltola will win the seat.
Mary Peltola was the first Democrat elected to the House from Alaska in half a century. Supporters of ranked choice said the reform delivered because she campaigned as a centrist. Here's how it works. There's no Republican or Democratic primary election. All candidates run in a single primary. In this special election, voters rank their four choices, eventually leading to a final showdown between Peltola and one-time VP candidate Sarah Palin. Peltola told PBS she won because she emphasized her willingness to work across the aisle.
You get a campaign where both of the individuals are on both ends of the spectrum. You know, do I want someone far, far left or far, far right? And all of their campaign promises have been about staying true to ideology, not compromising. And I have found that many partisan issues don't necessarily relate to a person's everyday life.
Anchorage pastor Andy Bartel is a fan of ranked voting.
Alaska, I think, is portrayed as this deeply red state, and yet there are a lot more people who are registered as nonpartisan than there are in either of the two parties. It allows people like me and other nonpartisan voters the opportunity to weigh in without having to necessarily commit ourselves to a particular party.
For now, Maine is the only other state which uses ranked voting, but it's bizarrely schizophrenic. Ranked voting is used in primaries for state elections and in the general election for federal elections only.
At the end of the day, voting should be simple, easy to understand, and anybody should be able to do it. And I think that ranked choice voting fails all of those tests, frankly. It makes voting a lot more complicated than it needs to be.
Jacob Posick is the legislative director at the Maine Policy Institute.
In Maine, since we have had RCV on the books, negative campaigning of all kind has gone through the roof. The amount of expenditures that are made by third-party groups, it went from, you know, the last gubernatorial primary in Maine had no negative spending. Then we get RCV and there's hundreds and thousands of dollars spent negative campaigning.
The Alaska election has sparked a national fight over the new voting methodology. This summer, five states banned it from ever being adopted, joining another five with a ban already in place. Hell, even Alaska is unsure. There's a proposed measure this fall to repeal ranked voting. On the pro side, four states will soon allow it to be used in local elections. Swing state Nevada has a referendum in place this fall to allow it to be used in the elections in 2026. Two major U.S. cities, New York and San Francisco, already use ranked choice in mayor's races. But research by Jason McDaniel at San Francisco State says those local elections have significant issues that should not be overlooked. People are often puzzled by the multiple voting dates and make ballot marking mistakes. Confusion's very high for people with lower education levels, and especially for immigrants who aren't native English speakers.
So the idea of ranking multiple candidates to me is something that right away I was like, this sounds like a kind of reform, progressive era reform. That what it does is it makes the voting task harder and will probably lead to less turnout and will probably lead to more ballot errors, right? And my research has shown that that's the case. My research has shown that turnout has declined.
Unless you're a political nerd, the odds are you're not going to be geeked by all these choices. Are you really going to know who these people are and what they stand for? I think you're just going to be bewildered.
So it's going to be uninformed choices. What will often be the case, I think, is they'll use race, ethnicity, last name, gender. Those things will come into play more, and there's research to support this, in that context, because they need something to rank them. And there's no guarantee they know policy differences, ideological differences. you know, substantive differences between candidates are not guaranteed to be transmitted to the voters very cleanly.
Seth Maskett at Denver University has his doubts about the real-world impact of ranked voting.
So the idea of actually doing like ranking a top four isn't going to really make that much of a difference. And you're going to get a Democrat and a Republican for the most part in the runoff. It might encourage a little more moderation from those candidates, but I don't think you're going to get a radically different, you know, type of politician in there.
So is there evidence it's led to moderation? Well, take a look at California. In California, the top two candidates in the so-called jungle primary face off in the general. But because California is such a Democratic state, it's usually just one Democrat against another Democrat. And nobody has ever made the claim that California politics in Sacramento has shifted to the middle. But Alaska State Senator Kathy Geisel was a longtime GOP state senator who was beaten in a primary because she wasn't conservative enough. But she was reelected under the ranked voting system, which she told PBS now rewards moderates from both parties.
We have a bipartisan coalition. It's made up of 9 Democrats and 8 Republicans. So that's 17 out of 20 members came together and said, let's work together. The difference in running in this open primary is that you actually do have to talk to everyone. I walked up to doors and knocked on doors I had walked past previously because they weren't Republicans.
A new twist on ranked voting is picking up steam called Final Five. There are basically two steps. You vote in an open primary for any candidate you like, and then the top five finishers go to the general. Political reformer Catherine Gale is the most prominent supporter of Final Five.
The rules of the game in politics even make prisoners of our senators and representatives. Their only option is lockstep allegiance to their side of the divide. So what do we do about it? We change the rules. It's not what we think. It's not gerrymandering, not the Electoral College, not the absence of term limits, and not even money in politics. Really, Final Five voting gives voters more choice, more voice, and most importantly, better results.
Well, chances are you're not a political junkie, so let's go to the sports world to explain it. Let's use all-time great quarterbacks, Patrick Mahomes, Johnny Unitas, Peyton Manning, Joe Montana, and Brett Favre.
A strike from Favre. Touchdown, Green Bay, as the Packers recapture the lead.
Yeah, I'm a Packer homer, so I'd vote for Favre. And then I rank the other four. So let's say your top pick, Manning, was now eliminated. So now his voters' second favorite quarterbacks get your vote. The card shuffling continues until we're down to the top two, and then somebody wins.
Brett Favre's dad, he has to be swelling up proud. The final score here at Super Bowl 31 is the Green Bay Packers 35, the New England Patriots 21.
Advocates say the system is designed to elect a consensus candidate and squeeze out the fringe ones.
The ultimate purpose of Final Five voting is not necessarily to change who wins. It's to change what the winners are incentivized to do. Under this system, the message of Congress is do your job or lose your job. Innovate, reach across the aisle whenever it's helpful, and come up with real solutions to our problems and create new opportunities for progress, or be guaranteed new and healthy competition in the next election.
Remember Mary Peltola, who won the ranked choice experiment in Alaska on a promise to buck her party? Well, she has. Well, sort of. On immigration issues and on energy issues, given Alaska's an energy-producing state. She votes that way if she wants to get reelected. Her party loyalty score shows she breaks with the party about 14% of the time. On the other side of the U.S. Capitol, Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski breaks with her party 36% of the time. And she was elected the old-fashioned way, by just beating a single Democrat. Since Bob La Follette's successful reform fight to let voters, not the legislatures, directly elect their senator, primary elections have been a fundamental building block of the election system. Proponents of open primaries point to Alaska as an important step, but many more primaries around the U.S. remain closed. 11 years ago, Nick Toriano ran as an independent for a congressional seat in Pennsylvania. After a one-sided loss, he founded a reform group called Unite America to advocate for more primary election reform. And he sees the Alaska experience as an important model.
I look at the winners of the statewide races in Alaska and see that a conservative Republican governor was reelected, a moderate Republican senator was also reelected, and a moderate Democrat won in an open seat for the U.S. House.
He wrote a new book, The Primary Solution, which argues that today's primary election structure pushes the most extreme candidates forward in both parties.
Right now, we have a system that overrepresents those at the fringes of both political parties at the expense of the majority. What was stunning to me is that in the last midterm elections, 83% of U.S. House races were not decided in November. They were decided in the primary elections months before November.
Listen to this startling statistic.
It was only 8% of voters nationally that cast ballots in those primaries that determined the outcome. So you have 8% of voters electing 83% of our leaders. It's no wonder why Congress doesn't represent us.
Remember, election rules are set by states, and America breaks down into three distinct primary rule clusters. Closed primaries only allow registered party voters to vote in a primary election. In 16 states, you have to be a Republican or a Democrat to participate in the primary election. Period. End of the discussion. It's no wonder that Pennsylvania's on the top of Nick's list. It's the state where he lost. It's way behind the curve, says his ally, Philadelphia civic leader David Thornborough, who wants to scrap a closed system that's nearly 100 years old.
You know, since 1937, when it comes to primary elections, you have to join a party in order to vote. And I mean, we've done all kinds of archaeological digs trying to figure out why this was implemented in 1937. And shockingly, it had nothing to do with independent voters, who were about 2% of the electorate at that time.
As we constantly remind you in our podcast series, independent voters are surging across the country, which we loudly applaud. And here in Pennsylvania, there are 1.5 million of them.
The twin barrels of the argument are that, A, it's unfair. Primaries cost us about $75 million a year. And if you're an independent, you're literally paying for a party that you're not invited to. The other thing is pretty clear is that when you elect people in a primary by a small number of the most rabid voters, you're literally then have the impossible task of trying to govern from the cheap seats in, rather than talking to the whole stadium. It should not be a shock to people that dysfunction, hyperpartisanship, performative politics kind of follows suit after, the way we elect folks.
Then there are some primaries that are semi-closed. For example, in New Hampshire, you can be an unaffiliated voter, read independent, and then the day of the primary declare as a Republican or as a Democrat and vote. In fact, as you walk out the door, you can switch back to independent. That was the crowd that rallied to Nikki Haley in her run this spring. And then there are about 20 states that are open. For instance, in Arkansas, you don't have to change your registration. You just ask for the Democratic or the Republican primary ballot. The pushback to many of these reforms obviously comes from party officials. They would argue that a political party needs to have control over who its nominees should be to support the party's ideology and agenda. In crude marketing terms, it's a way simply to protect the brand.
People organize themselves by parties. The reason third parties never get any place, the reason independents never get any place, is because what's an independent? What is it? Nobody knows. Okay, people call themselves independents. They don't know what it is.
That's Elaine Kmark, Clinton administration official and Democratic maven.
Parties are a shorthand for voters understanding democracy. So, you know, if you call yourself a Republican, it means probably you kind of like low taxes and you don't think the government should be in business. If you call yourself a Democrat, you kind of think that the government ought to help out people to a certain extent. Parties are critical to democracies, and otherwise you don't know what you're voting for.
But not all party activists agree. Republican columnist and Virginia voter Bill Kristol.
So I live in an open primary, really a non-party registration state. And I think it's healthy, and I do think it has some ability, independent voters, therefore, or less committed partisans, less extreme people ideologically have some ability to therefore influence the nominations in both parties.
Now, it's time for me to be the anarchist in the room. Here's another familiar rant from me. How the entire system discriminates against ticket splitters. You can't do this in the general election. For example, what happened in Georgia in 2022, where a Republican governor and a Democratic senator were elected. But no state, not a single one, allows you to ticket split in the primary. You can't vote in the primary for a Republican Senate candidate and then suddenly switch to the Democrat in the governor's race. Party officials would hate that, but I think it would be totally cool. Total chaos and incentivized ticket splitters, who I think could completely transform American politics. Hey, it's America. If I want to buy a regular Coke at the grocery store, I can also throw into my cart Diet Pepsi, an energy drink, and cranberry juice. This whole thing with only two choices sounds a lot like the old Soviet Union to me. But in the end, all this tinkering under the hood of the American election system, redistricting reform, multi-party democracy, ranked voting and its variations, and open primaries, what are the actual results?
Listening to candidates, pundits, and partisans, it would be easy to conclude that election laws are ground zero for heated partisan battles, with the United States' status as a democracy at stake. The heated rhetoric around election laws just doesn't match the evidence.
That's from a very interesting study by the Hoover Institute.
Democrats often accuse Republican-backed policies like voter ID of suppressing turnout of Democratic voters. Republicans claim Democratic proposals like mail-in voting invite fraud that benefits the other side. And yet, our research shows that partisan stakes are actually very low. That's because most voting laws only target a small fraction of voters, barely affect turnout rates, or tend to evenly target Democrats and Republicans.
Or how about giving felons the right to vote? Which party gets the edge? Depends on the state. It helped Republicans in 19 states and Democrats in 29. Now, on a philosophical level, I think all of these ideas are worth exploring. I'm a firm believer that the states are the laboratories of democracy. But let's keep in mind again, I've got the entire axis of evil covered. Journalists, U.S. congressmen, and lobbyists. And there's a corner of my reptilian brain that's very cynical. So, before we get all worked up about one plan or another, we actually have the data to analyze the results from 50 very unique state systems.
You know, how much does it matter what kind of nominating system these places have? And it turned out that, like, candidates from the most open states are just as polarized as those from the most closed primary states.
That's Denver University political scientist Seth Maskett, one of my favorite bloggers on Substack. Well, anyway, right behind me.
For the most part, they don't have very many long-term effects. It tends to, like, you know, put a different faction within a party in power. It tends to shuffle things a little bit, but only for a few years, at which point, you know, people do adapt to the system and don't make a lot of long-term changes.
Is it that people figure out eventually how to gain whatever the reforms are?
You could say that. Yeah, I mean, that's maybe the more cynical word for it. But yeah, people figure out the rules and they figure out what they want from the system and, you know, eventually figure out how to get it.
My headline on this is party reform. The studies of that show that has very minimal effects, if any. There'll probably be some negative consequences.
That's San Francisco's Jason McDaniel one more time.
And people, what they wish for, what they hope for, what they promise is incredibly unrealistic in terms of what tinkering with the rules of primary elections can actually accomplish.
Well, like an old battered Oldsmobile, America's democracy undoubtedly needs a regular tune-up and maintenance. But remember our cautionary tale in our episode about election security. Cameras in election counting centers, after Bush-Gore, were going to usher in a new era of election security and transparency. But without a play-by-play of what was going on, every time someone moved a box in 2020 and saw it on video, it fueled rants of election fraud. So the next time you pop up the hood of the car, tweak that bolt, replace that belt, be careful. Today's solutions to America's elections problems could be tomorrow's problem. Here's the team behind Lost in the Middle. Executive producer Jeff Mayers. Producer Todd Elbaugh. Creative team Claudia Luz and Tony Wood. Edited by Aaron Zummers. Music by Brett William. Production at Civic Media. And a quick thanks to our partners at the American Property Owners Alliance. If you like this episode of Lost in the Middle, please remember to subscribe to our podcast. And if you enjoyed it, please tell your friends and pals.
Broadcasting from the Civic Media Studios on South Main Street, this is Oshkosh Air Support, 1100 AM and 98.3 FM, WISS.
Looking for a roundup of the day's important headlines in a quick podcast form? Search no more. Find it now at WISS.fm.
You're listening to Oshkosh Air Support, WISS 1100 AM Berlin, W252 DR Oshkosh, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.